Hey everybody, welcome to another Canine Mind Freak episode brought to you by Canines on Duty. I am Brian, your host, and today with me is LEO canine handler Todd Mona from East Hartford PD. Todd has 18 years experience in law enforcement and 14 years experience as a canine handler. And Todd, you're on your second dog, correct?
Yes, currently I'm on my second dog. His name's Cassis. We raised him from a puppy, started him at 10 weeks old with my first dog, Bolter Shepherds, put him in the back of that police car at 10 weeks old, every day, every shift, raised him from pup to what he is today.
Nice.
And, the amount of hours that he has in that patrol car is, pretty similar to probably what he has in a kennel, being home. It's just, it's incredible how much time he's been there. Every overtime shift, you name it, he was there, and I was always working him. So,
which is great. That helps build the bond.
Oh, and as many people know, every time I would work my first dog at training or whatever, he'd be staked out watching him. So he learned by, visualization and everything. It was a good experience. I'm glad I did it. I learned a lot.
That's great, man. So the topic of discussion today that Todd and I are going to talk about, it's kind of a spinoff of the interview I did with Howard Young. Todd had texted me and he said, man, I'd really like to see you talk about this topic. And I'm like, well, why don't we just talk about it together? And what it is with Howard, we talked about what departments should look for in a potential canine handler and some of the red flags. And we kind of started touching on team cohesion. And Todd, that's when you texted me. And so this is what the topic is about: team cohesion, the battle between canine and non-canine officers. So Todd, what are some of the issues that, like, what inspired you to reach out to me? What are some of the issues that you've had to deal with between canine, non-canine in the past? And tell us a little bit about that.
So there's a couple roads to go down on this topic.
Sure.
I think the first one will start kind of like in a chronological order to kind of make it easier for listeners to think about it this way. You come on as an officer, and I think in some departments, depending on how successful a program is or how well run it is, you have a difference of opinions in terms of being a patrolman and wanting to get into the unit. And sometimes when units kind of have maybe just one dog versus a larger unit that has more dogs, you don't necessarily, or maybe you have a better situation where people can be like, this is what I want to aspire to be. I like this because of the right reasons. And that's when it should start getting into the patrolman's mind prior to being a handler, that you could be like, this is something I want to aspire to be. Either this canine handler is leading the way for me, he's demonstrating by example, or maybe this isn't for me because of the way he's leading and demonstrating himself. So, you kind of have a seesaw that you got to kind of balance out there. For me, I started really only applying to departments that had a canine program because I knew it was kind of something I wanted to get into. I love dogs. I kind of wanted to work with them. So when I got lucky to be hired by East Hartford, we had a tradition of a really strong canine unit that started about 1990, 1991. And I saw the handlers, I saw the work they were doing, articles in the newspaper, TV commercials for, the Canine Olympics, stuff like that. And, that was like, oh, these guys have a really, good bond, a strong unit, and this is something I want to go towards. And I think when you have people that are sincere and have the right reasons for joining a canine unit, that's when you're going to have you're just going to be an addition to the unit. That's going to be another building block for the unit to grow. You're just going to be strengthening that unit together. And sometimes what happens is you have some really good handlers that can mentor younger officers. So I had all my guys in my canine unit. They knew I had an interest And they always would, you know, allow me to train with them, you know, with only months on the job. In fact, one of my FTOs was a canine handler. He was the founder of our canine unit, Robert Kornfeld. And when I was with him, I didn't want to do anything except lay him tracks and learn about the dog. So for a couple of weeks, I don't remember learning much else about anything else other than the dog.
Right.
So with that type of environment and that type of mindset of this is what I want to do, this is where I want to be, you know, I always felt like it was sincere and was within me. You know, my thought process was to do everything I could to get into this unit. What do I have to do to better my chances? And that's where it comes into play. Okay, now you're an officer, you've established to your senior or to your canine handlers, like, hey, this guy wants to be part of the unit. He's trying here. And that's when you kind of got to weasel your way in and be like, hey, can I take bites for you? Can I show up at training? Can I lay you tracks? You know, hey, you're on my shift. Can I go run with you on a dog call when there's an armed robbery and there's a track to be conducted? Can I run as your backup? Can I go with you on this building search? I think all those things are good qualities that administrators and bosses should be looking for, and they should be able to get that feedback through their handlers as to who is going to be you know, a good candidate for a canine handler.
Mm-hmm. That's something that Howard and I talked about, was ego being involved. I've worked with handlers all over the world, and I can tell you that I have talked to those guys that you can tell were unfortunately egotistical. I mean, I've seen female handlers that their attitude was poor because of, I believe some of it was the pressure of being a minority in this field. I mean, there are more male handlers than there are female. I mean, truth be told, that's true. And so I've seen some female handlers work so hard to be a part of the team that they kind of overcompensated. And unfortunately, like, I like what you're saying, because you're saying if you can find somebody who's extremely hungry, they're going to show you that they're hungry by doing the hard work beforehand. Like you said, showing up, hey, let me take some bites for you. Let me go out on a track. Let me do this. Let me do that. This is all outside of your normal job, which means you're not getting paid for this. And that's a big deal. But I think that there's a lot of people that get into canine or SWAT, or, you know, maybe it's a bomb tech or something like that. You get into the specialty work, and it's almost like some people, not all, but some people, and I'm sure it's a small percentage, where they begin to feel better than everybody else. So they have this chip on their shoulder. The other responding officers don't. I've seen officers with a dog where nobody will call them because they have such a poor attitude. You know, they're arrogant, they're egotistical, even borderline narcissist, and nobody wants to call them, right? They would rather wake up a handler out of bed than call them because of their poor attitude.
And you know what, the thing that I love about canine is that you can't fake it.
That's true.
You can't fake it. Your dog is a product and an investment of everything you put into it. Your input is shown through the dog's output. Mm. So, you know, those egos and problems and, you know, wanting dogs maybe for the wrong reasons. And, you know, now with social media, I mean, when I first became a handler, I mean, there was nothing like social media. I mean, Facebook wasn't even around. So, like, you were in it to be in it. You know, you were just coming out of that suit and waking up every day looking at your body going, I have black and blues on every single portion of my body. And that was it. But now it's like, you know, hey, let's take one or two bites and show it on Instagram. And that's cool. Everybody does it. You know, I'm not knocking people, but what I'm saying is that should not be the reason you get into it. And, you know, speaking of team cohesion, is that you should be trying to be helping out that team prior to being a part of it.
Right.
And therefore, when that happens, I think for the most part, that's when you kind of get the egos. Egos don't rise to that occasion. You see what I'm saying? Most of the time when you get the guys that are showing up, so like in my training group, I got like three or four decoys as officers, that, you know, everything that I've learned and, you know, taken from, you know, like Franco Angelini and some of the other guys that are real big into bite work. And, you know, I put it on to them as much as I can teach them from what I know. And they're like phenomenal decoys. You know, they're doing, they're marking correctly. They're, you know, they're letting the dogs drive into them, giving them ground, looking away, mark. And those are the guys that are like, hey, they're helping our team. They're helping us become successful by teaching this dog and communicating all the correct things. And they don't even have a dog.
Right.
And when they learn it the hard way and go home and take off that suit, we just had training yesterday, you know, finally beautiful weather here in New England. And, you know, they're sweating and they're taking off that suit. And it's like, yeah, they're sweaty, they're tired, they're hot, they're bruised. And they don't even have a dog yet. And I know their egos are gone. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, that's beaten out of them by training. And
right.
I think they learn to respect working, you know, 10, 12, 14 dogs on different days of the month. You know, how much work it really takes to be a handler. And you could see different dogs are at different levels. So therefore it kind of sheds that ego where it's like, well, if I get a dog, I know I can have this problem. And I know I can have this problem. They can relate to problems. And that's something that they can look out for in their own dog when they finally get one. And, you know, like, again, that seesaw, man, you know, my dog needs more bite work. He needs more, you know, more building searches. So, you know, they know that problems exist. And I think sometimes egos come into play when you're not knowledgeable enough or you're naive to the fact that, you know, what it really takes to put into a dog.
Right.
You know, if you're just going to get a dog and be like off the ground and running and have this phenomenal, perfect machine, it's like, no, man, you're wrong. God bless you if you do. You
right.
know, it's great. I hope that's the case for a lot of people. But, I mean, we all know that's not the case. So,
right.
yeah, being part of that team and not yet being on it is to me, probably one of the most important things that I could ask for or, you know, have our administration or other towns and other towns ask me for input or to be on oral boards for future canine handlers in other towns. So, as you know, here in New England, our towns are like this big, right? So,
yeah.
You know, every town's got a dog or two or three. And what happens is, you know, we're just so close together because, again, the towns geographically are small. And we go and I, you know, me, a couple other handlers, a couple other trainers, master trainers, you know, we'll talk to the administrations and we'll be like, this is what we see as good qualities. This is what we see as bad qualities, going back to your last podcast. And we try to convey that message, but in terms of being like the team cohesion and actually getting through and working with people and then going on to the training and going on to your working with your squad on the road, those are two other roads, you know, I'd like to go down upon and talk about a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I can't remember if I brought it up when I was interviewing Howard or not or whatnot, but, you know, I know a department where there was a couple people applying for the canine position. One guy got it. The other guy was super pissed. He felt like he deserved it more than the other. And he flat out told this guy, he goes, I'm going to do everything I can to try to ruin this. And that's such a shame that somebody's ego could get involved like that and tell someone on your own team that you're going to try to sabotage their success. And I don't know if you've experienced that over the last 18 years in law enforcement, but for me, that's sad. And I've talked to other departments that are dealing with very similar issues where somebody's disappointed that they didn't get it. And so now, you know, and that's, unfortunately, that's human nature. When we strive for something and then we believe it's failure, we tend to, you know, kind of backlash or have these outbursts in order to express our frustration, for example. Or maybe they just don't like the person. Maybe somebody else on within the shift is maybe outspoken, maybe more loud, or maybe very quiet. And so people don't understand them. So I think a big part of the team cohesion is to be able to build a bond between the canine teams and the non-canine teams. I mean, what do you
think? Absolutely. And don't, and you actually even need to build bonds between canine handler and canine handler. Because there's always problems within a group. There's problems outside of a group. And then there's interagency problems too. I'm not going to say names or anything like that, but you know, there are different training groups and certifications, right? Different certifying agency or certifying accreditations that I think there's a lot of animosity too between. And it's just like, hey man, you know, we're all out here to catch bad guys.
Right.
I think that is what I've been going over this for years with my group and a lot of the people around me. It's like, you know, we forget that we're all still police officers and our main objective is to train as best as we can to prepare for real life situations and to catch the bad guys.
Yeah.
To catch bad guys. That's the button. Find dope or find guns or find bombs, whatever your area is with your dog. But that is what we have to do. And within that, when guys get a good find or get a good bite, you know, sometimes other people have animosity or a little bit of hatred towards that officer for doing well. And it shouldn't be like that. So, you know, it doesn't matter if one group trains one way and another agency trains another. It's, you know, when we're out there on the road, you need to work together. Because I know it happens in Massachusetts where you're at, and in Connecticut, it happens here, you know, every single day. There's overlapping of agencies, especially when things jump into from town to town. You know, I think East Hartford is like 18 square miles, so pretty small, but probably 8 of those 18 are Pratt and Whitney's airfield and like the meadows along the Connecticut River, which is just like swampland. So really, we've probably got like 65,000 people tucked into 10 square miles. So it's wow, heavily populated. And then Hartford is pretty much 18 square miles as well. And then you got like 160,000 wow, square people. So everybody runs and you jump over into different towns, into different borders. So sometimes you get on a call and it's a good call and there might be 2 or 3 cameras there. And, you know, we all were brought there from a chase or whatever. And it's like, no, time out. We need to work together and figure this out together. Dog here, perimeter. And take that time and talk about it amongst yourselves if you can to figure out a game plan. Hey, one dog on perimeter north, one dog on perimeter east. He was last seen running east. Who's got a really good tracking dog? I do. You do. He does. You know what I'm saying? Like, you need to figure this out on the road. So when we talk about team cohesion, it goes from your officer to your canine unit. And then it goes from canine unit to officers and then canine units to other agencies' canine units. It's got to be a 360 in almost everything we talk about and deal with, because if not, what happens? Bad guys get away.
Right.
Right. So, and that's where we're at. So I think this whole thing of, you know, learning to kind of come together and work together, no matter who certifies you, who trains you or whatnot, when shit hits the fan on the road, you just gotta, you know, everything aside, do your job.
Right.
And unfortunately, there's been times where I haven't seen that happen, and it's, you know, things have been done for the wrong reasons. And I think one of the big things I could talk about is that dog calls have been put over out on the hotline or something, and you get a dog that is coming from 10 miles away to the call, and there's a dog 2 miles away.
Right.
So, and it's like, you know, why are we affording a bad guy a greater opportunity to escape when,
right,
you know, and it, unfortunately, it's for stats, because people want stats, and, you know, that's sad. So, you know, we've kind of been, since I trained with just about everybody in my area, it's like, hey, let's just all try to go, whoever gets there first, run the call. And
right,
then whoever comes later, run with them, sit on a perimeter, help out. Because again, wrong people in certain places for the wrong reasons to get stats or to get the dog call, you know, it's not a good, it's not a good scenario.
Well, and let's go back to what you were saying about somebody else succeeding and other people getting a little jealous that they were the ones that ended up, you know, by chance getting the bite or getting the track or whatnot. And I wanted to talk about that for a moment from a psychological standpoint. And I can't remember the term for it, which I'm a little disappointed at myself for that, because normally I know these terms like left and right, but I'm having a little bit of a brain fart. But so I don't remember the term, but it is a bias. And what it's, the way it described it, huh?
Self-serving?
No, it's not self-serving bias. I want to say it's like intrinsic bias or something like that. I don't know. I'll have to find the term and I'll put it in the description. But anyways, the way that my social psychology book described it was that if Jill is, her thing is mathematics, and she takes a test and gets an 80, and her friend who doesn't give a shit about math gets a 90, Jill is going to be pissed off at her friend. Right. And so there's typically three things that she's going to do. One of those, she'll completely sever the friendship because she doesn't even like math. How could she do it better than me? So like, I don't even want to be her friend anymore because now it's a challenge, right? Or she'll sabotage her success, or she'll just verbally and mentally belittle her. Right. So she's going to insult. And all this is designed to protect our ego. Now, if Jill's friend was into bowling and Jill didn't give a crap about bowling, if she scored a perfect game, she would cheer her on because that has nothing to do with her value, how she determines where her value is. Well, we know canine handlers. Canine handlers value the performance of their dog and the performance of their deployments. This is why we're seeing those egos and the selfishness and the jealousy behind another handler succeeding. And look, I get it. I remember when I was in law enforcement, you know, I got put on day shift for a while and there wasn't crap going on day shift. Like all the good stuff was at night because of our demographics. So it's like you'd hear about this major thing, you know, barricaded guy with a knife or something. You're like, dang it, how come I couldn't have been on that shift? And like you feel that because most of us are adrenaline junkies. That's why we do the job, you know? We like the driving fast, the, you know, wrestling bad guys, and all the stuff that is a part of that. But I want people to know that this has actually been studied psychologically, and it's subconscious. So in other words, we don't even realize that we're treating other people poorly because of their success. And it's our subconscious way of protecting our ego. So I do want our listeners to understand that this is a real deal. I think there's going to be a lot of listeners that are saying, oh, we don't have that at our department. Well, I think every department does, because we're dealing with other human beings. This is why I love what you're saying about building the bond between the humans, with the canine, the non-canine, and then the canine and other canine teams, and then neighboring agencies and their canine units. I think what you're talking about is right on. When we look at that psychological aspect, you're saying, hey, look, we need to really come around 360 degrees and take a look at all these different dynamics and how can we work good and smoothly as a team that has that cohesion, that has that brother and sisterhood without being at each other's throats. So that's why I like what you're saying. And I'm curious, do you have an instant throughout your 14-year career as a handler, is there a story that you can think of where there wasn't team cohesion, the effects that had on maybe deployments or training, and then what did you guys do to remedy the issue, or was it never fixed? Can you think of a story? And if not, that's fine too.
I could think of stories where it's happened and we found people, mm-hmm. And like you said, we're human. Like, you're always going to say, like, damn, I wish it was me. Like, you know, like, because I think everybody does want to prove themselves. When you put the time and effort into something, you want to have a crack at it. You want to have a crack at the bat. And, you know, you want to, you know, sort of give yourself and your dog an opportunity to at least see if you can be successful and catch somebody, you know, whether it be a tracker or a billets or whatever. But so I'm not going to lie and say I never thought that way. But in the instances that I'm thinking, we have found the person. And what happens is I think the people who were there with their dogs that haven't found them, yeah, they were upset it wasn't them. And it was upset to the point where, you know, things have been said and people had to be spoken to on the side because of their attitude about it. And it's like, whoa, we caught the guy. You know what I mean? We caught him. It's over now. We got him. So, you know, so be it. But it's good. And you should be happy for Handler A, because you work with him, you train with him. You should be happy with him, for him. You know, you shouldn't say things that, you know, kind of belittle, you know, maybe the track went off for a little bit and then you don't, you know, the air current was going this way. And guess what? Your dog got really off the track. And next thing you know, he's almost like area searching the guy and, you know, kind of, more so trailing him than tracking him. And, you know, the track turned into an area search and that's how you found him. So be it. I don't know where the scent is going, but you right. shouldn't, try to criticize, well, he didn't even track the way the guy went and he's lucky he found him. Those are the things that kind of make me a little bit, you know, bothered inside, because it's like, hey, you know, again, we first of all, at In Services, I like the guys to talk about their calls that they had over the last 2 weeks or so. So you learn from one another. Sure. You should be able to talk about all your dog calls, and you should be able to learn and grow from each other and maybe not make mistakes that another handler makes. So if I have a problem and I said, I think I lost this guy here and I know what I did wrong. I misread him, you know, whatever the case may be. I want the other guys to know that. Mm-hmm. So they don't make the same mistakes. And it shouldn't be that, you know, well, yeah, see, he's not even tracking them the right way. You know, you see what direction I'm going with.
Yeah,
that.
Absolutely.
So those are some of the examples I could think of. Normally we've rectified it and talked it out amongst ourselves. And, you know, hopefully it gets to the point where no bosses have to ever, you know, hear about it or whatever. But, you know, again, I think it just goes back to that. We all want to have an opportunity to be successful. You know, and depending on where you work, some guys get more work and more opportunity than others. Mm-hmm. You know, and that just comes with the environment you work in. So
yeah, I remember when one of the companies that I ran before, we had an interdiction instructor that worked for us. Terry Fleck was one of our instructors. And it was interesting because when I'd listen to the interdiction instructor, who was phenomenal, you would hear guys would raise their hands and they're like, man, our demographics, I don't get big busts like that. And of course, these are all canine guys. So it was interdiction specifically for canine handlers. And the gentleman who was our instructor, as well as my business partner at the time, he was, you know, I think he had 20 or 30 years as a canine handler, master trainer type deal and all this other stuff. He was on the level and he was good. And he would like show his dash cam videos of where he got, like the one bust that he got, there was like 1900 pounds of marijuana. And you'd see these guys raising their hand and they're like, well, my demographics, there's no way. The most I get is like 3 or 4 grams. That's it. You're finding, you know, 3/4 of a ton of narcotics. So you could tell that they were a little jealous because they're looking for those big things. And you would hear it as they talked and as they asked their questions. So we know that this is a real deal. And everybody feels it.
But they should not think that way.
Exactly. I agree. I agree completely.
It's like, you know, it's almost like, you know, that law of attraction where it's like, hey, you surround yourself by good people, you know, and you grow yourself and you better yourself. And then it's like, you know, if you think always negative, it goes right to your dog and everything's going to be negative. You're going to get out of the car to go do your next search and be like, I'll be lucky to find 3 grams.
Yep.
And it's like, that's your mindset. So, you know, what happens if you miss it because you subconsciously are just like going around the car, kind of doing your thing, like, but it's outside of your training regimen. It's not as detailed as it should have been. Or maybe there's a trap there and your dog, the odor's flowing differently and your dog catches something differently and you're like, ah, no, it's a tailpipe. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it just, you don't, you're not reading your dog right because up here is not set correctly.
Yeah.
And I think if you go out there and you, like when I do, for example, when I go on a track, I don't care how old, how silly it may be. Like, you know, like even when you're like, oh, it's a smash and grab of a convenience store at 3 a.m, you almost know they got into a car around the corner, right? And they mm-hmm. carried all the cigarettes and cash as much as they could take to the car and they left. But when I do those tracks, I tell myself, no, they're out here. They're out here, and I'm going to try to find them. And I do everything I can as if I know the person was on foot bedded down. You see what I'm saying? So my routine and my mental routine is the same as my physical routine. That's just the way I've always been. Anytime you say, oh, I don't think I'm going to find anybody on this, you're setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah.
So that mindset of going out there and thinking, oh, this is all I'm going to get, it's like, don't put yourself in that. Don't do that to yourself.
Yep. You know? Yeah, man, go ahead.
No, it's okay.
Okay. I can't tell you how important that is, that topic that you just brought up, mindset, right? I remember when I was going through sniper school in the Marine Corps, we had a mindset class, and it was right before we went to SEER school, which is a POW school. It's the only school in the military where they can, you know, beat you. And I got waterboarded twice, and I graduated with a busted lip, a swollen eye. And they talk about mindset and how to remain positive all the time. And then as I've been studying psychology, I realized there's a lot to this because the chemical responses in the brain. We believe chemical responses just happen because they just happen. But the main reason why chemical responses happen is because of what we're thinking about. So if you're thinking about things that stress you out and you're thinking about them negatively, your brain is going to produce cortisol because that's the fight or flight hormone. Those thoughts are saying, I'm in danger, whether it's ego's in danger, whether I'm in physical danger or mental danger. Either way, those are going to trigger those fight or flight responses. So now you've got high levels of cortisol. Cortisol weakens your immune system. It inhibits the action of the white blood cells. It increases your chances of infection. It promotes weight gain. And what's that?
Yeah, I'm probably going to die soon. I get a lot of cortisol dumps.
Well, not if you have the mindset that you're talking about, though.
That's right.
You know, it's funny because we don't realize how powerful our thoughts are. And we've seen those scientific studies on people when let's say you're working on a car and you can't get a ratchet on a marred up nut, for example. And all of a sudden now you're getting pissed because you're frustrated. This should have been easy. It's not easy. And now you're getting angry. Well, now you start beating stuff and you end up breaking stuff. And now you're more stressed and then you make more mistakes. Then you get more stressed and make more mistakes. And that's really what you're talking about, is that if you have a poor mindset, not only is it going to impact team cohesion, but what about how the dog views other handlers or other officers within the team? I have remember dogs learn through watching mom or dad, right? It's called social referencing. And there's been a ton of scientific study that proves that people who had compassion on the dog owner, the dog would willingly take treats from. But people who treated the handler poorly, the dog avoided them and wouldn't even go to them. So now if we take that scientific study that I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe it was done by Dr. Stanley Coren from the UK, or maybe he wrote about it. I can't remember now, but either way, we know that they've actually done scientific study on this. So imagine having a canine handler who has a problem with another officer, canine or non-canine, it's irrelevant. Your dog is picking up on those signals. Your dog is saying, well, if dad doesn't like that guy, I don't like that guy either. So yeah, literally how you think and behave is going to train your dog or modify your dog's behavior and how they treat others. So
I think this is kind of one of the reasons that, you know, I really started following you, you know, probably about a year ago now, or, you know, try to follow you religiously here. And like, because you have one of the areas that I feel like I'm lacking in, you know, like I feel like, I've building search. That's my thing. And, you know, I love doing building searches. I have like a little building search class I put on. It's my thing. I work my areas with my dog, but I think one thing I was lacking is learning the psychology of my dog and humans and interrelating and all that. So that, you know, that's why I've been trying to, you know, learn from you as much as I can. And I think it's helped me realize a couple things along the way. And one of the things that you were kind of just talking about it with is how the dog reads us. Right. So here's the thing. My guys make fun of me because my dog barks a lot. Mm-hmm. And there's several reasons I think the dog barks a lot. But the test is when there's a good call that comes in, like a shooting, car's leaving, we're getting description of the car. I haven't turned on my lights or sirens yet because I know it kind of is a trigger for my dog, right? I will actually drive slow and I'm listening to the radio because I don't want him to bark and have me have problems hearing the radio, right? But what happens is when I'm driving slow, I know I'm putting off a certain scent. I know I'm excited. I'm like, I am going to hunt this guy down. I am going to catch this guy. He is going to crash and bail and run on foot and I'm going to get the bite. That's what I'm saying going to like those types of calls, right?
Yep.
And I know that my dog is sensing something for me. I am putting off some sort of odor. I hope it's not fear. I know it's exciting because it's like, I want the hunt. There's nothing better than hunting, man.
Right.
But he will pop up out of the back and I know it's because I'm putting some sort of odor off myself and he's just in tune. So that's going to the canine handler, canine team cohesion. It's like that dog is sensing something from the handler, like, hey, dad is putting something out. You know, like I said, he's got to be smelling me. I got to start sweating. You know what I mean? Like I'm getting excited. My heart's beating faster. He knows it. And, you know, I'm looking around, I'm doing my thing. He knows that I'm out there hunting. And that, believe it or not, is what will key your dog up. I mean, that should be almost like lighting him up and not waiting for the lights and sirens as a visual and audible, you know, spark to do it, right? In training, guys would be like, you know, watch him or pass off and, you know, it's to get the dog pumped up, right? But like in the real world, when you grab him out of the car like that, because somebody just ran, you know, bailed out of the car or ran into the woods, when you grab him like that and that intensity is there at training, that everything coming from you, from your hand now onto the collar or leash of that dog, your body language is the communication, the cohesion from you giving it to your dog now and releasing it into your dog out into doing his job.
Yeah.
So, maybe I'm crazy for noticing those sort of things.
Not at all. I'll be honest with you, Todd. I wish more handlers would understand those principles right there because it's true. Number one, the moment you start thinking about something like a fleeing suspect and you're on the hunt, your brain, that thought is producing the adrenaline, which is cortisol, right? It's derived from the hyperpituitary adrenal gland. And so most people think that cortisol and adrenaline are two different things. They're one and the same. Cortisol is adrenaline, right? It's the fight or flight hormone. And so it takes, even after the event is over, it takes 1 hour for our body and a dog's body to come back to baseline. So the moment you have those thoughts, yeah, you're right. Your brain is producing loads of that cortisol or adrenaline. And because you do start sweating subconsciously because of excitement and potential risk. I guarantee you, your dog is smelling it, you know? So that's good observation. And I think that more people need to understand that your dog is picking up on cues that you don't even think they're picking up on. Like body language even. There's been a crap ton of studies on that. But definitely chemical responses in the brain for sure. I have seen so many times where, I told this story when I was interviewing Howard. I had a guy call me and he said, my dog's sitting by my side when I deploy him on a car. But then when he's training, the dog does fine. It's only on real life deployments. Turns out his dog was screwing around on a real life deployment. He gave him too hard of a correction. I agree that maybe the dog should have been more tougher than that. That's what Howard was saying. That dog shouldn't have broke under that kind of pressure, but he did, you know, and truth be told, we have independent dogs and we have handler dependent dogs. This dog happened to be handler dependent. Dad reefed him because he was screwing around on a deployment. And what do most handlers do? They put him in the heel position in the sit to try to refocus him. So now when the dog deployed, the guy, he was thinking that way, oh, I better sit by dad's side because I'm about ready to get corrected again. And then he calls me and he says, I got a hold of somebody at dispatch. The dog's never met them, doesn't know the car, pulled him over. The dog searched the car fine. I said, yeah, but what's the difference between somebody you knew and somebody you don't know? It's going to be your mindset. The dog knows when the difference between your behavior when you're calm and your behavior when you have a lot of adrenaline or cortisol. So that's why he couldn't replicate it, because he knew the 911 dispatcher. So when he pulled her over, he was nice and calm. He knew she didn't have firearms and narcotics and all that other stuff. But you take a strange person, you have a heightened sense of awareness that that dog is picking up. And that's why it was so hard for him to replicate the same adrenaline and alertness in pulling over somebody you know. That's why training can be challenging at times. Because it's hard to replicate real life.
Sure, and that's why doing the scenario-based, then, you know, you kind of just show up to a call and your dog's not expecting it, you know, or you try to do the best you can where it's like you drive around the town for a minute or two, and then it's like you got the building set up, you got the guy in there, you got your backup there, and, you know, so scenario-based training, you get out and do it like you really would in the real world, you know, it says something for, you know, in terms of the dog's mind, it's like, hey, I wasn't expecting it as they do in training. So, you know, if you can come out with that intensity, if you can have the handler in a non-stressful situation come out, but bring up his intensity, hopefully it translates right down the leash to the dog, and, you know, the dog can grow from it too.
Right.
And, you know, that all goes back to like your training groups. It's, you know, you guys got to, you know, do scenario based challenge and push your dogs and be intense as you would. It sounds silly to say, because everyone always says it, but it's, you know, fight like you train like you fight, but you kind of have to with these guys, with the dogs, because, you know, they don't know yet, you know, especially in the beginning, they don't understand these things. They have, especially when they're in an academy and they haven't stepped out into the real world yet.
Yep.
You know, it's those type of things that you could do to kind of bridge that gap between a training environment and a real world environment that can help your dog succeed, you know?
Right. Right. Now, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole on training and all that other stuff. I think that was relevant to bring up because we were talking about mindset and all that other stuff. One of the problems that I've noticed as I talk to handlers all over the world is non-canine handlers really not caring about crime scene preservation. So they're contaminating, you know, say a track, or they're searching the car too much. What would you say to another handler who's struggling with this? What would you do if the non-canine guys were contaminating the scene and always forgetting or willfully not giving into your request? Because every department has canine policies. And typically, I know in the policies that I advised when I had my kennels, was this was the department policy. Non-canine handlers must preserve the scene and not contaminate the area that is to be searched by the dog, correct?
Sure. Yeah, we actually at East Hartford, we do all the new cops come in, they get like a 2-hour PowerPoint, and we go over everything. They have a PowerPoint where it tells you what to do just about in every type of call. And then we'll do it periodically every couple of years at an in-service, not for canine, but like a regular classroom training for the other officers. We just kind of bring it up, touch on things. And then, you know, the best advice for this is like roll call, you know, roll calls. Yeah. To talk about crime patterns, who's out there doing what warrants, but it's also the canine handler should take the opportunity to be like, hey, yesterday went really well because of A, B, C, and D, or U, or hey, yesterday went pretty poorly. It could be better if we do this, this, and this. And that's why the squad cohesion is also another, a whole nother dynamic, which is key. So look, I work evenings, and I've had for like the last 5-6 years, even most of my career, I've had, a really, really good bunch of guys to work with, and girls, you know, to work with. And the better you are as a squad, the better chance you have for success. So once all these guys and girls start to realize what their job is going to be on an armed robbery, or hey, we were chasing a car and I lost it for a second and now I found it crashed, abandoned, nobody in it. Like, guys are going to start to know where to go without even telling them. anymore. Because in the, right. initially, you got to be like, the handler's got to pick up the air, pick up the mic, and start to direct people as to where he might want a perimeter set and this, that, and the other thing. And what happens is over time, and when if you're lucky enough to work with the same group of people year after year after year, month after month, I think everything sort of starts to flow much more smoothly. And people get put in certain places and people take certain positions automatically. It's subconsciously, guys coming from the south end, if they're going to a north end call, yeah, they're going to go to the southernmost portion of that perimeter. And when those type of things happen, that's what betters your chances for success with the canine. And, you know, you're really only as I mean, if somebody keeps running, you know, obviously it makes your life harder as a handler. But if you can contain them, trap them, and pin them down, I mean, then it's just a true-on hunt. And it's just like everybody came together. And what happens is, so I think subconsciously in all these officers' minds, when you all come together on a big hot call like that, and everybody has you know, a certain role they played, and they know they played it perfectly, and you guys caught the bad guys, got the guns, and everybody was a part of it, it makes it just a stronger bond and a stronger bond. And before you know it, it's okay, everybody's thinking positively, right? Everybody from the supervisors to the canine handler to his dog to the rookiest guy in the squad, everybody's been like, man, we've been catching everybody. And their whole mindset changes. It's like, we're going to catch this guy. So the whole squad is thinking this way, not just you translating down to your dog, but everybody. And then when that happens, it's like, I don't understand if it's just, you know, coincidence or what, but when those type of things happen, I mean, we kill it on the road. That I attribute so much of my success to all the people I've worked with over the years. And, you know, as a canine handler, most people, we just stay in patrol, right? Or we support patrol. And what happens is you get all these new cops that come in, you have to retrain them, you have to talk to them about everything. And then just as they're getting good, they go to narcotics or they make detectives.
Right.
And so you got to redo it over and over and over again. So good canine handlers will hopefully be able to keep coaching and training the new guys. And before you know it, it's like, you know, everybody has gone through your canine handlers, right? And they've all been part of something special in catching bad guys out there, and they've all played a role. It makes for a more successful unit. It makes for a more positive environment, and everybody's mindset is now, you know, we're going to catch this guy. You know, it's not like, man, last time I screwed up, I don't even want to go to this. And, you know, there's the guy driving 2 miles an hour trying to avoid going to the call versus the guy that's, you know, lights and sirens trying to get to where he needs to because he knows we're relying on him.
Yeah. Yep. Well, and you brought up two very, very important things that I think our listeners need to soak in. One, as the canine handler, you are not afraid to tell people that they did a good job. That's important. That's operant conditioning. That's positive reinforcement, right? You're encouraging your people to keep making the same decision. And especially with somebody that has rank or years of service like you do, talking to somebody that only, say, has 2 or 3 years, like a fairly new officer, to come from a veteran like you to say, hey, what you did was awesome. You did great. You assisted in this. Without your actions, it wouldn't have worked out the same way. So thank you. I think that there's handlers out there that don't do a good enough job reinforcing the good things that non-handlers do. The other thing that I really like that you pointed out that I don't think happens enough, and again, I talk to handlers all over the world, and I'll ask them, did you have a class? Like if they're telling me, hey man, how do you get the non-canine people to stop contaminating the scene? I've yelled at them time and time again. Well, first off, nobody responds to yelling. I like that you guys have a PowerPoint presentation. You sit down, it's classroom setting. They haven't done anything stupid yet. And you give them the class. That way everything is calm. There is no attitude. There's no anger. There's no frustration. It's like, hey, just so you know, this is how we expect you to conduct yourself and assist us. I think that's genius. And I think more agencies need to do that. I think there's a lot out there that do something very similar, but I've talked to I would say 100 handlers that they don't have anything in place like that. That is good. I really appreciate that, Todd, that you do that and that you brought that up, because I didn't even think about that.
One of the other things too, I see it a lot more so in smaller departments. I think in departments that are a little bit busier, kind of have a little bit more problem with violent crime, it doesn't happen so often. But, you know, some of the smaller towns, you'll get a canine handler who's, you know, he's got some fines, he's got some bites, he's been to perimeter and containment class, you know, he's been to a tactical tracking class. So he's got some, you know, solid training under his belt for when a critical incident happens, you know, out on the street. So here around Hartford, East Hartford, you have some really urban areas. And then immediately one town over, you have some really, really rural areas. And things sometimes, you know, transfer over into those rural areas. And now all of a sudden you have a supervisor on scene who's now in charge because it's in their jurisdiction, kind of, you know. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that supervisor, because of his rank, and, you know, maybe he has more time, maybe he has less, but because of his rank, really, you know, doesn't allow the canine handler to do what he needs to do because he thinks he is in charge, which he is. However, it's just a good piece of advice I could give people if they're listening to that. If this is your situation and you've rubbed, you know, your supervisor or your supervisor's rubbed you the wrong way during a serious call, you know, talk to him aside, talk to him before those things can happen, and explain to him what exactly your role is and what you need, so that when it does happen out on the road, your supervisor's already aware of what you need. So if you pick up that mic and you're like, hey, I need somebody here, 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 and here, or whatever the case may be, he's not going to be like, no, you don't go there, you go here, and you right. go here. So it becomes a pissing match over the air. And meanwhile, nobody knows what the fuck to do, and then bad guys get in the way. You know what I mean?
That's right.
So talking to your supervisor and involving them, you know, luckily my patrol lieutenant has been my canine sergeant. Then he got promoted to lieutenant, and he's been my canine lieutenant, and we came on roughly the same time together. So we're, you know, we're pretty good. But for the most part, over the years, our supervisors have allowed the canine handlers to, when we pick up the mic and say, hey, can I get somebody here, do this or do that? They know it's because we know, and they know because we've talked to them about it. We've explained our job to them in terms of what's required for us to better our chances for success. So when they're clued in and they understand it through your eyes, and they can ask any questions and you can answer, you know, their questions, and so that everybody's on the same page, that's what really allows things to come together too. Because the last thing you want to do is have all your officers on the same page and you're like, I got everything where I need to be. And then somebody's like, and then the boss is like, no, I need guys here, somebody else to go to the scene because I want for photographs or fingerprints. It's like, whoa, photographs and fingerprints are going to be there in an hour.
Right.
You know what I mean? They're not going there. Yeah. But as long as the correct, you know, the correct timeline can be relayed to a supervisor in terms of what we need, you know, the better, because we'll all be able to work together from supervisor down to, you know, down to patrol. So.
Right. Well, and I think that's a good point that you bring up too. I think this maybe applies more to young handlers. Don't be afraid to speak up. Don't be afraid to tell the shift supervisor or whoever is in charge of you what it is that you need. I think people are intimidated because maybe they're new, or they feel outranked, or that their voice doesn't matter. I say give it a shot either way. I'd rather say I'm sorry than to keep my mouth shut and not say anything. You need to tell the people that you work with and the people that are over you, hey, this is how I've been trained. This is what my capabilities are. These are my strengths. Now that I have this dog, cut me loose, man. Let me do what I've been trained to do. And that's a philosophy that the Marine Corps was very good at. They knew how we were trained. So when my staff sergeant sent us out, that was it. You're going to go here, you're going to go there, and then I'm going to let you do your job, and I'm going to shut up. And he was phenomenal at understanding that he could have faith in us. Yes, we were young, you know, we were 19, 20, 21 year olds, you know, in this position of top secret clearance and hunting down bad people, you know, but he cut us loose because he had faith in the military training. And I think if there's supervisors listening to this too, I've seen those supervisors. I've talked to those supervisors where they didn't cut their people loose and trust that they would do a good job. Some of them had reason to not trust them, but others just simply wanted to be in charge. Again, it was feeding the ego. Look at me, I'm organizing. I got 14 guys. I'm organizing this whole thing. And they want to take that control so that they feel like they've contributed. Rather than just cutting people loose, hey, you're good at what you do, I trust you. To me, that's a good leader.
That's right. You got to always lead by example and have, you know, set the tone for others in a positive way. So, you know, if you have to work with somebody, a supervisor like that, it's just best to talk with them behind a closed door and just mm-hmm. let them know what you need and hope, you know, they give you what you need because it's for the reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. For the life of me, I can't understand why people don't value communication over anything else. To me, communication is number one in any social interaction. One of the biggest things that I told my wife before we got married, I said that the biggest, most important thing to me is proper communication. Everything else is secondary. If you and I can't have a conversation about difficult things and actually have a little empathy and compassion for the other person, having the understanding that you're not going to see everything the way that I see it. My sight picture is going to be a little different than yours. That's perception, right?
Absolutely.
Our brain makes up everything that we see and experience, which means that I can look at this mouse and see something completely different than what you see. I see this as dark black, but your perception might say, well, that's not dark black, that's dark gray. How can I argue that? Just because it appears black to me doesn't mean maybe you got an eye problem, or maybe you've never seen anything that dark black. You know what I mean? It's all about how you perceive things may not be how someone else perceives it. And the only way to find a happy medium is to communicate properly. But it seems like in this day and age, people are afraid to communicate and tell someone else, first off, what it is that you need, then what do you want, and how do we go about doing this, right?
Sure.
I just don't see that enough. So I think that that's a great suggestion that you brought up for really any type of police officer. I think this even relates to outside of canine, even if you're a patrolman. If you've got a need or you have a specialty in training, like, I don't know, you know, maybe you were prior military and you went through CQB school. So you should be the number one entry guy on a dynamic entry because of your prior experience. Well, no one's going to know if you don't talk about it.
That's right. And that kind of goes into the, you know, your cohesion with, you know, your trainers. So I think one thing, I don't think we've really gotten into it, but you as a handler should be going to your trainer if you have problems and talking about it, because sometimes I feel like guys will, you know, maybe they don't want to expose all their problems that they have. So let me give you an example. So when I was with my first dog, I was with a different certifying agency than I am now. And it was taboo. We weren't allowed to train with anybody else. And I went to, at the time, he was a Napawada master trainer, Bill Knott. And he's been doing this for probably 35 years now. But Bill, I was having an issue with gunfire. And I was really embarrassed that my dog was gun shy. And it was nothing I did. When I had him and first got him, we tested him on gunfire and he was great. And something went wrong in the academy. I know exactly where. But I had no control over it, unfortunately. So I couldn't deal with it there because we only had a couple opportunities to train it, and that's where it went wrong. So I knew I had to fix this because, you know, I was one of the busier agencies that was in that class, and, you know, dealing with the environment that I was working in, I felt like I really needed to have a dog that was good with gunfire. And, you know, I went to Billy Knott with Napawada, and, you know, I was like, Billy, you know, thank you for taking the time, but this is my problem. And, you know, Billy worked with me, and we went to some of his other buddies that were master trainers, and we worked it, you know. And if you didn't take the time to go and talk to other trainers and just be open about your problems,
yeah,
how are you going to communicate getting across what you need fixed if you're not doing that? So talking about it, having the guts to come out and be like, hey, this is my problem. It's pretty embarrassing. I can't have my dog around gunfire. But bringing that problem and presenting it to a trainer and actually talking about it is a whole nother thing. So,
right.
You know, I think, you know, there's something that needs to be said for, you know, going back and talking to your, you know, the people who trained you, your training group, maintenance trainer, however it is you're structured, but getting into talking with them about issues. Maybe right. You don't like, maybe a handler feels like what you're doing for your that guy's dog is not enough, or it's not working right. Well, bring those issues to your trainer, to me, or whoever, you know what I mean? And figure it out. Don't just shut people out and then continue on down that path and make the problem worse. Because
right.
The trainers aren't out there on the road with you. So if certain things are going wrong and you can't fix them in training, well, where are you going to fix them?
Right.
You know, I never in a million years would have thought I would have went through, you know, 3 shootings with my first dog. I didn't shoot in all of them, but I'm just saying he was there for 3 shootings.
Right.
And thank God, Billy, you know, told me, he goes, hey, Todd, you know, when your dog is in drive, he's fine with gunfire. It's when he's just out for a walk around the obedience line, not really in drive or doing anything, is when he has a problem. So unfortunately, during most police shootouts, your dog should be in some sort of drive and,
right.
you know, be looking for a target, or, you know, you have him doing a task. He's in hunt or he's in prey. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So luckily I was able to get the bite on actually 2 of those.
Wow. That's awesome.
And that actually helped, you know, it helped the dog get better and stronger with gunfire. But,
right.
You know, if I didn't take the chance and go see somebody in another agency, I might not have known that. And I may have left my dog in the car on those calls if I didn't know what Billy told me.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
You know,
very good point.
Going outside your box of who you train with, you know, I mean, it's the best thing you can do is learn and talk to other trainers and see what's out there. And, you know, even if you only take 1 tidbit of information and bring it back to your team or to you and your dog, I mean, anything is going to help. Knowledge is power. It's you got to do it for yourself.
Right, right. Absolutely, man. Yeah, man, Todd, this has been an amazing conversation. I think that people really need to take this to heart, both canine and non-canine related. So just to recap for our listeners, we talked a lot about mindset and where your mindset should be. You brought up the being mission oriented, which is to intercept the flow of narcotics, tracking down and apprehending suspects who have broken the law. That should be the focus of what we do. So when someone else is successful, cheer them on. If they're struggling, help them out. Don't let your ego get involved to ruin that connection that we can have between the canine teams or even the non-canine officers. We have to exercise humility. You got to be able to be humble in order to have proper communication. As you brought up, Todd, having a conversation with your supervisors or neighboring supervisors, letting them know what your expertise is in, your training, what you're good at, what you're not good at, and then, you know, giving them your request. What do you want? Well, I want to be cut loose. Just let me do my thing. You guys paid for the training. Let me do my thing. And the other, to me, besides the communication, because communication trumps all, but I love what you talked about, educating the non-canine handlers. You do that young, with these young officers coming into the agency, sitting them down, having a PowerPoint, and going over the do's and don'ts of what to do when you know a canine team is going to be responding or if they call a canine team. Phenomenal information, Todd. I know that this is going to inspire some people, some of our listeners to want to take this information to their department and kind of spread the word on this particular podcast. And this is a great piggyback off my interview with Howard Young that we posted last week on Friday. So I think this really plays off that really good. So Todd, thank you so much for bringing your expertise to us and all our listeners and sharing some of your stories and your insight on team cohesion, the battle between canine and non-canine officers. Appreciate you, Todd.
Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it. And I look forward to listening to all your podcasts in the future. You've helped me out a lot. I think your psychology aspect behind all this stuff is incredible. And, you know, if handlers are listening, tell other handlers about this podcast, because it is from a perspective that I didn't really know existed. And the more I get involved in this, it's like with you, it's that area just keeps growing.
Yeah.
It's getting bigger and bigger. So it's good. And thanks again. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And if anybody listening wants to learn more about canine psychology, I'm going to post a link to our webinar. Right now it's $99 and it's between a four and a four and a half hour class. It's broken down into three modules, but I'll just put the link where you can purchase that. It is our basic dog psychology class. I'm filming an in-depth one that's going to be $300 and it's going to be sold through caninefto.com. And that's canine field training officer. That's for all you handlers out there. I would check that out if you're new, because this is everything you didn't experience in your canine academy. Everything you need to know, from deployments to maintenance to all sorts of different stuff. You can head on over to Canine FTO. We're going to be redesigning that website as well. I talked to the owner. We're going to redesign that, make it a little bit more user-friendly. But in the meantime, check it out. Look at the topics that they cover. And Canine FTO has been one of our sponsors that helped make this happen. And along with getting the payments for the dog psychology webinar that we have, that's helping us continue with this podcast as well as our other videos that we put out. So we would appreciate the support. And heck, you're going to learn something as you go through this, I promise you. So Todd, thank you for the kind words. We really strive to bring the best knowledge to our canine teams that are out there. So thank you so much for what you even do for a living. That sacrifice you make every day, leaving your family, going out there, chasing down people that have broken the law, trying to intercept those flow of narcotics is awesome, man. My hat's off to you. I got a ton of respect.
Thank you.
All right. Till next time, everybody. Stay safe. Watch your six. And as always, Semper Fi.